Welcome to Embracing the Muse. I'm your host, Sally Jean Fox, the author of Meeting the Muse After Midlife. And I'm on a quest to discover and understand how we can live our richest, most meaningful, and creative lives at any age, and especially as we age. And I'll be interviewing island creatives to discover what they can share with us about the highs and lows, ups and downs, and possibilities of living and sustaining a creative life. I'm really happy today to bring you a favorite Vashon artist, Gail Lurie, who is a beautiful potter and also a real contributor to the Vashon arts community. So there was an article on Gail in the Beachcomber, I think it was last year, and I was fascinated because you see someone, they're your friends, but you don't know what an incredible background and how much training and how much history and experience has gone into their craft. And I was quite blown away by that Beachcomber article. It did you justice. It was a really great article. So I wanted to talk to you, and also because right now I think you're still president of the Vashon Island Visual Artists,
yes.
Viva, which is a great contribution to our communities. I was really interested that you had been a teacher for a while before you turned to ceramics. Can you tell me a little bit of how that happened?
Well, they both kind of started about the same time. I was about 22, I had just come out to Seattle and just was starting my teaching career, and I had to walk by the community center in Rainier Valley where I was teaching, and I poked my head in and I saw a pottery class, and oh, that looks really fun. And I took a class. And I've been hooked ever since.
Oh, my goodness.
That's a long time ago.
Yeah. But for a while there, you supported yourself with teaching.
Yes. Yeah. I taught for 26 years.
Wow.
In Seattle, mostly in Seattle public schools, and mostly at Summit K-12, which was a public alternative school, kindergarten through 12th grade, with a really strong emphasis on the arts.
Oh, great.
So,
were you teaching art school. Or what?
I taught art briefly, but I was mostly teaching primary grades. That was my age group that I really loved working with.
And always a good exposure to encouraging play.
Yes.
And
yes.
Artistry, even if it's not specifically
yes.
art class. You
exactly.
Know?
Yeah. I would teach, electives to the high school students, but mostly, just regular second, first, third, great teaching.
Yeah. Although I think actually it's pretty good background to the extent that artists need to know how to play, need to get out of their own heads.
And young children don't have the hangups that people get as they get older in school. So they're very free with their art and with everything. And I kind of love that.
I have a theory that can shift around third grade if kids aren't properly encouraged. What was your experience?
Well, my worst experience was my student teaching experience. I had probably the worst teacher you could imagine. She had the kids paint a sun. She had an easel up front. Every kid had a piece of paper and two colors, yellow and red or something, yellow and orange. And she made the circle, and then she made the sticks out from the circle. And of course, the kids, I think it was a first or second grade class, they'd start making their lines at the top, and they just keep going, and they never, they kind of got curvy as they went around. So almost every kid had a terrible experience with art. They failed, basically.
And I just wanted
to scream, say, no, don't listen to her.
Yeah. And also, they probably thought we're not doing it right.
Right.
Because maybe that was a great way to do the sun. Just let it go wherever it went. And make it around the circle.
It was really funny, but it was sad. Also.
It was sad because.
It was really sad because I could just see them getting turned off to art.
Yeah. And they begin to make conclusions like some of us did that nope, this is too hard. I can't do this.
Yeah.
Leave it to somebody else.
I'm not an artist.
I'm not an artist. How many millions go through school?
And of course, anybody can be an artist if they want to be.
If they want to be.
Mm-hmm.
Well, you were 22 years a teacher and then at
26.
26. Was that when you decided to go to the University of Washington and apply to their ceramics?
No. It was 7 years before that. I took a sabbatical.
Ah.
And I was very fortunate. Now you can barely get into the ceramics program, but I just applied and they took me in. I already had a master's degree, so I didn't really need the credits, but they took me in what they called a special student. And they gave me my own little studio, and I got to work with three amazing people, Jamie Walker, Patty Warashina, and Akio Takamori. I mean, I was just incredibly lucky. And I could just do whatever I wanted to do, basically. I signed up for all the ceramics classes, but I basically did what it was mostly like independent study.
Were you trying to get a master's degree? Or
no, I already had a master's
so you didn't in
education, so I didn't really need it. I got more credits, and then I think that helped with my salary when I return a year later just teaching. So,
well, perfect, because some people don't have that great experience when they go back to grad school to do an MFA.
Mm-hmm.
But it sounds like for you, it was fabulous.
It was very freeing for me, yes.
Yeah, I mean, I can't imagine. It sounds like a kid in a candy store to be given a studio.
Yes, I know. I can't believe
three world-renowned instructors.
I know. It was an amazing bit of luck.
Yeah.
And the timing was just right. And I lived near the university, so that was great.
Fantastic. Did you, at that point, decide that you really wanted to be a full-time potter as soon as you could?
Mm-hmm. And so they don't even give sabbaticals anymore, I don't think. But at that time, you had to work 7 more years. And that was fine because I was still enjoying teaching. So I taught 7 years and then I decided, okay, now it's time to be a potter.
Fantastic.
So I took early retirement and left teaching.
Did you have any concern about supporting yourself as a potter or?
I do get a small pension, not a whole lot, but it's something that comes in every month. And I didn't want to do any substitute teaching, but for 8 summers, I did the ceramics program at Northwest School. And it was part-time, but it was a lot of fun. And, you know, I did make some money doing
that. So you were teaching in the ceramics
program.
Yeah,
nice. But just in the summer.
Yeah.
Like, whatever, 8-10 weeks, something like that.
Yeah. I know it's a big jump to go from doing something and potting on the side to saying, I am a potter.
Yeah.
And I need to, if not cover 100% of my cost, at least cover my supplies and generate some income.
Yeah.
And,
mm-hmm.
Yeah. And were you by yourself or did you have a partner who shared?
Well, I have a husband. Mm-hmm. And so he was still working, which really let me do that. I probably couldn't have done it just all on my own.
Yeah. I ask because I think people have to put together their own combos to make the art thing work.
Exactly.
And to be real, to be able to say, okay, I'm not the sole breadwinner or, you know, I am the sole breadwinner. So maybe I need to have a pretty good side gig that pays my rent.
Right.
You know?
Well, luckily I had a husband and that did allow me that freedom.
Did allow you. Yeah. So how did that lead you to Vashon? How did that fit into your ceramics career?
Well, I have a friend on Vashon, Lynn Holly, who is an amazing ceramic artist. She can do functional work, but she does mostly sculpture. And she had been trying to get me to move out here for a long time. And I don't know why Vashon just wasn't on my map, on my radar. But we had decided we wanted to leave Seattle. And we were looking at Port Townsend. But then Lynn said, why don't, you know, we're going to India for 6 weeks. Why don't you come and stay in our house and see what it's like to live on Vashon? So we came in February and fell in love with it. And we were there 1 week and we ran to Emma Amiad and said, find us a place. And that's all we needed was 1 week.
That's fantastic.
And we just kind of knew this was the place for us.
Oh, that is so great.
Yeah.
So great. Was the art community on that? I mean, did you get to meet some of the art community? Was that an attraction for you?
I knew a few people because I had been previously president of the Washington Clay Art Association.
Okay.
And so I knew Liz Lewis and Marla Smith, not well, but I knew of the, I knew them a little bit, and that was about it. Mm-hmm. Other than that, I didn't really know other artists at that time.
So why did we win over Port Townsend?
Well, it was February and it was nice weather most of the time, and I don't know, we went to the roastery and it just happened that they had the band was there playing, and I thought, oh, this is really nice. I could live here. And the views and the nature, we love to hike and kayak, and it's just so easy to do that here.
Yeah, so, yeah, no, I get it. I just taught a class in Port Townsend, and I loved it out there,
yeah.
But I felt more distant. And
yes.
To the extent that I still love Seattle and, mm-hmm. want to pop over and do a course every so often.
Yes.
It's nice.
And also, both my children live in Southern California. And so I have 5 grandchildren and they're there also. And, I told my son, we're thinking of moving to Port Townsend. He said, no, Mom, that's the wrong direction. So Vashon fits the bill because it's, it's 20 minutes to the airport once you get off the ferry. And makes it a lot better to get to California. I go there quite often.
So how many years ago did you move here?
2015.
So
it'll be 10 years this summer.
Great. And did you immediately start getting involved in the art community?
I did. The first thing I did was I heard about the studio tour. Mm-hmm. So I signed up to be on it immediately.
The Vashon Island
Viva. Tour. The art tour, which is now coming up December 7th and 8th, 14th and 15th. Put it on your calendars.
Yeah, and sidebar, don't miss Gail's studio.
Number 7.
It's really wonderful, and she has some other artists with her who are also wonderful. But so you jumped into Viva right away.
I did.
Okay.
Yeah, I knew that I needed to make connections that way.
And what did that give you, being part of Viva?
I felt like I was part of a community of artists, and It gave me a place to show my work at my studio during the tours. And we always have the Viva member show once a year. That's coming up in May. And the mini show that VCA puts on, I knew I could probably show in that. So, yeah, that was my goal.
Well, that's lovely. And then you've gone on to have a leadership role in Viva.
Yes.
If I understand right, you're about to finish your term, right?
No.
Oh, you're not?
Fairly new.
I still
have about a year and a half to go.
Okay.
Yeah.
It's
all volunteer.
Yes,
so people really need to know that, this organization works really hard for them, and it is all volunteer.
I know.
It's much all volunteer.
It's important to remember that because sometimes people think, well, why doesn't it work like this or this?
Yeah.
And you go, well, do you know what it's like to run an all-volunteer organization?
Well, we actually do have 2 people that we paid to do things. So mm-hmm. The graphic artists and, to put out we have beautiful posters and brochures, and all that work is done professionally. And then we pay someone to be our tour coordinator now in the last few years because it was just too huge of a job.
Yeah. Yeah. That tour coming up in the first 2 weekends of December and then again in May is a real highlight for the island. People come over for it.
Yes, they do. They come from all over. It's amazing.
Yeah.
And I know we get a lot of return customers from Gig Harbor, Tacoma, Bothell. I mean, they know about it.
Wow.
We do a lot of publicity. Mm-hmm. Off island as well as on island.
So outside of the studio tour, why would one want to be a part of Viva?
To have a sense of community. I guess that's the main thing.
Yeah. I think it's great because, you know, a lot of us work independently, mm-hmm. whether we're artists right. or writers or creatives.
Studio alone all the time.
In the studio alone. And to just know that you have a network.
Right.
Out
right.
there of people you can ask, but just a sense mm-hmm. of, you know, brethren.
Yeah, you know? Exactly.
It's so great. Well, thank you, because that's a huge, being president of anything, but especially something that's so dear to the island is a big deal and all. When I've been to your studio, I fell in love with the raku that you do. Mm-hmm. I am in particularly interested in Japanese arts, but I understand that raku did not start in Japan.
They say it's considered a Japanese art form, but evidently it came to Japan from Korea.
Interesting.
Which I was really interested in learning about.
And for an outsider who isn't staring at one of your beautiful vases or bowls, how do you distinguish raku from other forms of ceramics?
Well, it's a totally different kind of, it's a different firing system. So I need a separate kiln, and it's a fast firing, whereas a normal kiln, the bisque firing takes about 6.5 hours, and the glaze firing can take anywhere from, you know, 8 to 12. So if it's a wood firing, you know, 5 days. But a raku firing is very quick. And what the magic really happens after the pots come out of the kiln. So the kiln is designed so that the top comes up. It's called a top hat kiln. And you only fire a few pieces at a time, maybe 3 or 4 pieces max. And you have to go in when the temperature reaches roughly 1800 degrees, but you have to eyeball it to see if the glazes have melted properly. And they're red hot and molten. And you go in with long handled tongs and protective gear. You have to pull it out very quickly and not scorch your eyebrows.
Oh my
and
gosh.
Immediately put it into a metal can that is filled with combustible, so sawdust or shredded newspapers, and it starts a fire, which is very exciting, especially if you're a pyromaniac. It's a lot of fun. You see the flames.
It sounds terrifying.
Well, the first time people do it in the workshop, they're a little astounded, but it's all really safe. It's very contained because it's all in the can. And after all the stuff catches on fire, because as soon as you put the pot in, it will start a blazing fire. And then after about 15 seconds, you put the lid on, which smothers the fire and it sucks out all the oxygen, and the carbon that's left goes into the pot. So if I use a crackle glaze, like those black and white crackle ones that you like, that glaze is designed to crack. Hopefully the pot doesn't also crack.
Oh my goodness.
You know, coming from, you know, 1800 degrees to whatever the ambient temperature is outside. And then the carbon goes into those cracks and makes the black lines. And then there are other glazes that just have that are not designed to crackle, but they have a very high mineral content. So it brings out the carbon, the firing brings out these amazing colors that look almost psychedelic, you know, the magentas and the aquas and the purples. So it's fun.
Is that, what's it like to not know whether your pot is going to break?
Well, that's kind of the fun of it. At this point, I hardly ever have a pot that cracks anymore. Of course, when I started, yes, they did. And they don't all turn out beautiful. You know, sometimes just the temperature, the wind, just different outside atmospheric things influence it a lot.
Interesting.
And the main thing is the timing of when you get the pot into the can. If it gets too much oxygen on the way in, it can be a completely different color. So it's kind of like magic. You know, you really don't know exactly what you're going to get.
Yeah, it sounds like magic, but it also sounds like raku masters, and I would include you, get an intuitive sense
yes.
for how it's supposed to
right.
work.
Yeah, that helps. Having done it for 40 years,
yeah.
has a little influence on it. But, you know, I do workshops in it, and you know, most of the pots come out really most nice. But you know, we get some real ugly ones sometimes.
Yeah. Well, you and I were talking just before this interview started about what people don't know goes into making a mug, for example.
Yeah, yeah.
That often, you know, we go in and we say, heck, I could buy a mug for $10 at the store, or ouch, it looks like it's going to be $30, $40 to have this handmade mug. And we have no clue mm-hmm. how much effort had to go into right. the handmade version. Can you walk me through like how,
okay,
what
so
that process
example,
is?
I can throw a bowl, a medium-sized bowl, pretty quickly. I mean, I still have to trim it, texture it, shape it if I want a different shape, you know, fire it, glaze it, refire it. I mean, there's still a lot of steps. But with a mug or a pitcher that has anything that has a handle takes a lot longer. You know, you have to make the piece, then you at the exact right temperature, or you have to trim it, then at the exact right drying stage, you have to make a handle and attach it, and the attaching takes a long time to get it really nice, so it looks like it's just coming right out of the mug, and that it fits a hand properly and it's not crooked, and you know, you don't mush it up with wet clay on your hands or something. And then you still have to bisque fire it, and at that point the handle could fall off. You can lose it at any point. Then you have to glaze it, and you could make a mistake in the glazing, and then you have to refire it. So it's a very long process. It's not just throwing the piece.
Is this for a raku mug or any mug?
No, any mug.
Any mug.
Anything, yeah.
Because your raku vases aren't necessarily watertight. So right. Would a mug be watertight?
I don't do raku mugs.
I wondered about that. Yeah.
Yeah. Although I guess the old Japanese masters did, and they liked the what the tea left in the mug.
Interesting.
Yeah.
Yeah.
And I don't know. They weren't completely watertight, but I guess it didn't matter to them.
Thank you. I mean, that gives me a lot of insight for how much goes into that simple mug that we
right.
see.
And if you want to have a texture on it, that can take, you know, anywhere from 5 minutes to an hour, depending on how intricate the carving is.
Amazing. So, amazing. Yeah. Well, you have been making pottery now for 40 years, did
no,
you say?
About 55 years.
55 years. I keep getting my times wrong. I have to extend them another decade.
I forget
decade.
How old I am sometimes.
How, you're mid-70s or?
Yeah.
That is, it's like keeping a love alive for 50 years.
Exactly.
Yeah. How does that go? I mean, have there been moments where you wanted to just slam the door and walk away?
Yes. You know, when I first started, I was, you know, it was the 70s, and I was, you know, doing macrame and candle making and a whole bunch of different crafts. But once I started with clay, it was pretty much, this is it. And I just don't have time to do the other ones. I still like to do other things, but I just don't have the time really.
Mm-hmm. Do you still love it? I mean, is mm-hmm. it still
I
exciting
do.
For you?
It's so challenging because people also don't realize it's not just one kind of clay. There are hundreds of different clay bodies that you can buy: white, yellow, tan, orange, black, chocolate brown. I mean, so not just the colors, but they have slightly different qualities, and porcelain or stoneware or earthenware. And besides the different clay bodies, then there are different firing techniques. So I've done mostly all of them. I do electric firing because I have an electric kiln. But when I was a resident at Pottery Northwest, I used a big gas kiln, and that's called reduction firing. And then I've done wood firing and huge onagama kilns that are really fun, but they take 7 days to do the whole process. And then there's soda firing. There's all these different ways you can fire a pot to get different effects. And so let's see. And then of course, different glazes. There's thousands of different glaze combinations you can use. So I just never get bored.
So interesting. Do you still study or?
Oh yeah. Yeah. I'm constantly reading, you know, ceramics magazines, and now I don't take as many workshops. I've taken a zillion workshops over the years. When I was a resident at Pottery Northwest, we could take any workshop that came there free. So, you know, that was 5 years of, you know, several workshops a year. And when I was up at Shoreline College, same thing. We could do free workshops. So I took advantage of all of them. And I got to see some of the best potters in the world. Or in the country, at least.
How fantastic. Have you traveled to Korea or Japan to see their work?
No, but I'm planning on going to Japan next year. Ooh. And I'm going to go to Shigaraki, which is a big pottery village.
Really? Where is it?
I'm not sure. It's somewhere not too far from Tokyo or Kyoto.
Yeah. I had this funny thing happen when I was, many years ago, a boyfriend of mine had lived in Japan, and he said, bring me back a bowl. And I knew he meant ceramic, you know, mm-hmm. And then I was baffled because on the one hand, they had tons of manufactured ceramics. Yeah. Mm. Just mass produced ceramics. Oh. And then when I finally see the bowl that was gorgeous, it would turn out to be a tea bowl that was likely worth $1,000.
Right, right.
And they didn't have the mid-range. In fact, when I came back to the Northwest, I saw more bowls that were like what he wanted because they had that sort of Japanese ethos, mm-hmm. but they weren't in the living national treasure, historical tea ceremony category. So you could afford them here. You know, mm-hmm. I think still it's an amazing thing to be able to buy a little cup for $40 or $50 that has that handmade essence in it.
Yeah.
That is just so wonderful. You know, given, I don't know exactly how to say this, but I would think that it's kind of intimate creating something of beauty in Raku. You know, you pour a lot of yourself in. There's a certain magic. You don't know exactly. You can't just mass produce a bunch of them. So they're kind of living treasures in their own right. And then you share them with the world, like on your studio tour. Do you ever feel like, you know, wanting to say to people, these are my babies, you have to love them?
I do feel like that. I absolutely do. You know, I feel like I'm sending my children out into the world. And sometimes I'll ask people if I can come visit, if they're good friends.
You can come see mine.
Okay.
Yeah. Well, is it hard? Well, because the other thing I know sometimes about the studio tour is some people are cruising and they're not, you know, they're not really there to be interested. It's sort of a fun event. But I would think as an artist, that might be a little hard to see people cruise in and cruise out and not really appreciate what you've got.
Yeah. There. Well, no, I understand that, you know, because it's fine. And I don't mind if they just come and look. I mean, I appreciate them looking. And honestly, some people just aren't interested in pottery. They come for the jewelry or the leather or the glass that I have at my studio, because I have 8 different artists in my studio.
Yeah.
And that's fine too. But I get it.
You know,
When I go to another studio on a studio tour, I mean, I go straight for the pottery or, you know, the textiles or whatever I'm interested in. So
yeah.
I understand that. That's
but
fine.
I think it is. There's this tension between producing what comes out of you and is so, you know, much a part of you, and then having to realize that the world will, some of them will love it and some people will not even see it, and others will.
Well, that's funny because I love wood-fired pieces, and they are incredibly labor-intensive. Like I said, I used to go down to Sand Lake, Oregon, and it was you glazed and loaded your pieces for one day. I mean, it took that long to load this kiln. It was a huge kiln, and, you know, it was a 7-person team that had to do it. And then we fired it 24 hours a day for 5 days. And so you're on a 4-hour shift, you know, you're sleeping in a yurt with a bunch of other people, and you're, you know, stoking the kiln for 4 hours and sleeping and then getting up and doing it again. And then you come back a week later and you unload the kiln, and that takes a half a day or so. And then I would have them at my studio. When I was in Seattle, I did it more. And people would just walk right by the wood-fired pieces. They'd see brown. And they would just walk right by that and go over to the more colorful things. I was like, wait a minute. Don't you see the beauty? You know, but, you know, if a potter came in,
yes,
they went and looked at those,
yeah,
and they really could appreciate them. And so, you know, whatever,
yeah,
it's okay.
And I think that's sometimes a part of the, not for everybody, but a part of the Japanese eye to be able to see into things that are traditional handcrafted and kind,
yeah,
of see what they represent in a way that we might not.
Exactly.
Get.
Yeah. The whole wabi-sabi thing.
Yeah. I love it. Yeah. What's the, if you could say, or if, what's the hardest thing about living a creative life or being an artist?
Well, probably if you don't have a partner, making a living at it. You know, I have a friend who is an amazing, she specializes in crystalline glazes. And it's a very tricky technique, and she's a master at it, and she's taught workshops all over the world, and, you know, her stuff has been collected. And she was living hand to mouth up until, I don't know, maybe 10 years ago when a friend of hers died and left his house to her. And so finally she had some financial stability. And I thought, this is ridiculous. This woman is amazing, and she can barely keep her head above water.
Yeah, that's where the Japanese have the living national treasures,
right,
or ways to endow artists,
yes,
who are doing things that are gorgeous but not lucrative and all. Has your relationship to your art shifted as you went into your 70s? Or
not really. I just keep evolving. And I wouldn't say I've had any major shifts.
No major shifts, no. Yeah. Yeah, yeah.
No, but there's still lots of things I want to try and I want to do.
Your work is physical. I mean, being able to put it in a kiln, get it out at the right moment, work the clay, you know.
Yes.
How do you see yourself continuing ad infinitum?
Yeah,
you
know? Well, it is getting harder. I mean, mm-hmm, a bag of clay is 25 pounds. You know, so just picking up the bag of clay, putting it on the table to cut off a piece to work with, I mean, that's getting harder than it was when I was 22. And I don't sit at the wheel as long because I need to get up and stretch or else my back will get tight. But yeah, I can see doing it forever. I might switch more to hand building.
Mm-hmm.
I do hand building and throwing. Mm-hmm. And I might do more hand building later on. If the throwing gets too hard.
It's so wonderful to have something that you still love,
mm-hmm,
and with some modification to be able to say, there's no retirement. There's,
right,
no reason to move,
exactly,
away from it,
yes,
as long as you can physically manage it and you love it. You, mm-hmm, know?
So I should be able to. And, you know, I might have to get some help loading the kiln or something because that also is physical. You have to bend over and put the pieces in and lift the shelves out, and they're heavy.
Yeah,
so,
yeah.
But, you know, you can get, or wedging the clay.
Yeah.
So when I'm 95, I'll get an assistant maybe.
Yeah, or an apprentice who wants to glean some of that knowledge
maybe,
from,
yeah,
you. So if people want to, I want to ask if people want to see your work, where they should go, and also if they want to learn from you, how can they do that?
Well, I don't teach classes right now, although I may start because I've just getting so many requests. I do teach Raku workshops. I do a few a year, and I have to do them mostly in the summer or spring, fall, when the weather is good. You can't, because the kiln has a hole at the top, so you can't do it when it's raining. So the Raku workshops, I have a running list of, a mailing list of people who are interested. And as far as classes go, I just usually, if I do start doing some, I will probably just send it to people on my mailing list.
Mm-hmm.
So
yeah,
if people are interested, they can.
So let's tell people,
list.
Yeah, how do they get on your mailing list?
I guess
they can email DrPottery.
GaileLuriePottery at gmail.com.
Okay. We'll put that in the show notes and all.
Okay.
And now it's coming up to a time when they can actually see her pottery.
Yes.
So let's talk about that.
Oh, good. Yes.
Your studio number 7.
Number 7.
In Docton.
And we're really lucky this year. We have 8 studios in Docton.
It's an epicenter.
Incredible.
There.
It's becoming a little art colony all on my street. I mean, that was another stroke of luck, just moving there on that street. And other artists moved in and some were there. And there are a couple that haven't shown for a long time and are back on the tour, like Kathy Lahr's daughter and Corey Wynn, 2 excellent artists. And then we have some new people who have moved in the last few years. Barbara Newton, who's an amazing painter, and Allison Buchanan, who does glass bending. She does neon glass. So there's glass bending. And she has a really amazing studio.
Across the street from you.
Yeah, right across the street. And then, you know, there's other good artists just up and down my street.
Yeah, well, it's definitely worth a pilgrimage all the way over to the wilds.
And, you know, this summer, I don't know if you were around.
Oh, yeah, come.
You were. Yes, that's right.
Come.
You were there. The Docton Art Walk. We had our first annual Docton Art Walk. And we had no idea how many people would come. We had 7 studios. And it was just 2 days, and we had over 600 people in Docton, which is truly amazing. It's, you know, I can sit at my studio and see 3 cars go by in a day, usually.
Yeah, and I thought it was actually a really great event because it came at a time in the summer where you weren't competing with, you know, 20 other studios in the studio tour. And Docton is actually quite beautiful.
Mm-hmm.
And so to be able to have a little excursion and maybe walk around Docton and
the historic trail.
The historic trail and then see the diverse artists and all.
Mm-hmm.
I thought it was a lovely event. And I think it was in part credit to some work on your part, right?
Yeah. And we had music at the on the porch of the old Docton store and a food booth. And we're going to have even more next summer. It's going to be an annual event because everybody just loved it.
Well, I bet that everybody who went said, when are you going to do this again?
Yes,
and then others said, hey, we want to be a part, or we you know, why don't you do?
Yeah, we're going to have a few more people that have come out of the woodwork that we didn't even know were also in Docton that are artists. So that'll be fun.
Really great. Well, I want to thank you for not only making art, but being such a contributor to the community, because that spirit that brought everybody to Docton, that it's really infectious.
Mm-hmm.
And it makes people excited.
It was very exciting.
Yeah. And so, you know, they don't have to wait till next summer. December's coming soon. And it's also a great time to look for Christmas things and holiday gifts and to enjoy your beautiful pottery. So thank you for giving me some of the backstory on your
pleasure.
Your 55-year career, right?
Yep. Yeah.
Yeah. Thanks. Thank you.
Thank you.
Thanks so much for listening. I look forward to being back soon and bringing you another conversation with an island creative who can show you how it's possible to embrace your muse and live your richest and most creative life. Till then, thanks for joining us, and thanks to Voice of Vashon, 101.9 FM, for hosting this show. I'm your host, Sally Fox, and I look forward to being with you soon.